You're listening to the Ideas Energized podcast, produced by the LARDA Institute. LARDA is a Los Angeles-based nonprofit organization whose mission is to foster science and technology innovation for a sustainable planet. Since 1993, LARDA has helped over 10,000 startups translate their ideas into sustainable enterprises, products, and services that have environmental and social impact. Learn more at larta.org. That's LARTA.org.
Hello and welcome to the LARDA Institute Ideas Energized podcast series. My name is David Barakoff. I'm the director of the energy practice at LARDA. Over the past 25 years, I've had an opportunity to work on a number of interesting technology and business initiatives, which include hydrogen production technologies and fuel cells. The potential value of hydrogen fuel cells in a sustainable energy economy was recognized way back when in the 1990s and served as a critical foundation for really where we are today in terms of technology reliability, product availability, and decreasing costs. My guest today is Dr. Jack Brower. He's a professor of mechanical and aerospace engineering at UC Irvine. Jack is the director of the Natural Fuel Cells Research Center in the Advanced Power and Energy Program. Welcome, Jack, to the program.
Thank you very much, David. It's nice to be here with you and nice to have known you for so many years to advance these very important technologies.
Thank you, Jack. I'd like to ask you a question about your background in the area of hydrogen and fuel cells. How did you get started in this area, and who were your principal colleagues that you work with to where you are today?
Well, thank you. I was very fortunate to be recruited to UC Irvine by Professor Scott Samuelson way back in the late 90s. To focus attention on hydrogen and fuel cell technology here and how it could be advanced to achieve zero emissions throughout society. And with his mentorship and leadership, and fortunately with UC Irvine being in the state of California, which leads with regard to concern for the environment, concern for emissions, we've been able to make a lot of progress and to increasingly learn that hydrogen, fuel cells, and electrolyzer technologies are going to play a very important role in the decarbonization and the removal of air quality pollutants, okay, in all sectors of the economy. And if you really want to achieve zero emissions in all sectors, you absolutely need the features that hydrogen, fuel cells, and electrolyzers can provide. So fortunately, we're sitting on the precipice of the world realizing how much we need these things, even though Professor Samuelson and I have been talking about it, been doing research with outstanding graduate students and postdocs for more than two decades.
Thank you, Jack. That was a terrific background, and it's been certainly a pleasure to working with both you and Scott Samuelson over the past several decades on solving some of the most important challenges related to hydrogen production technologies and fuel cell products in the marketplace. Mm. I just would like the audience to note that we're going to be splitting this podcast into two parts. The first one will focus on existing net zero carbon technologies, plus the history of hydrogen and fuel cell technologies and their maturity to this point, how we're transitioning today in society from relying completely on fossil fuel derived hydrogen to a more sustainable resource, including renewable technologies. And then part two, we'll discuss hydrogen and fuel cell global markets, applications, and whether the existing infrastructure, AKA natural gas pipeline system, can be used effectively for hydrogen storage. Plus, we'll cover some policy recommendations required for hydrogen and fuel cell solutions to achieve widespread adoption in society. So As a background, in terms of where we are today, just to refresh ourselves, where society is and where it's headed, there's growing concern, obviously, about the impact of climate change. And there are growing numbers of key stakeholders, policymakers, driving towards a zero net carbon future. Now, some policymakers, as we all know, are advocating for complete electrification of society from transportation to end use, especially, you know, for instance, in California and other areas of the US and throughout the world. We also recognize the growing popularity of electric vehicles. And we also know that the cost of power generated from solar and wind has decreased dramatically over the past 20 years, and now in many cases are either on par or lower than fossil fuel generated electricity. The hope among many of these key stakeholders is to gradually phase out the use of fossil fuels and potentially nuclear over time. But there are practical challenges which must be addressed. And we're going to be discussing some of those issues today in this podcast. For instance, what happens to the grid when the sun does not shine or the wind stops blowing? Where does it get its electricity from? And also, what do we do with the growing amount of excess renewable generation in the afternoon, the late afternoons of certain days throughout the year? Can we utilize that electricity for practical energy application so that we're not wasting it? Some policymakers and key stakeholders are beginning to explore other sustainable energy solutions to help fill these gaps, such as the emerging hydrogen economy, et cetera. So I guess, Jack, the first question for our audience is, can you please explain what do we mean by the hydrogen economy?
Thank you, David, for that introduction. It's using hydrogen and its zero emission features to enable zero emissions in all sectors of the economy. There are certain things that hydrogen can do better than other known zero emissions technologies, and making hydrogen from sun and wind power when it is available, and then storing hydrogen and then later using it for producing electricity can engender long duration and massive amounts of energy storage, which both will be required to do, as you say here, power the grid when the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing. And sometimes we need it for a long period of time. You know, the wind might not blow for a couple of weeks in a row under some circumstances. Or the solar power that's available in excess in the springtime especially really wants to be given back to us in winter. And then how do we move all of that energy that is so massive in its extent over such long periods of time? And hydrogen has that ability to do that at a lower cost than alternatives like battery or pumped hydro or things like that. It also is lightweight, and so it enables some transportation applications that require heavy payload. It can also fuel vehicles very quickly. So if you have that kind of need, it can do that. So it has a whole bunch of features that engender zero emissions in sectors of the economy that couldn't be made zero emissions without hydrogen.
Thank you, Jack. I recall back in the early 1990s, when I started working on fuel cells and hydrogen production technologies, we've been talking about this hydrogen economy as being imminent within, say, the 10-year timeframe that these mm-hmm. products would come to market. And I found it was really interesting. When I was at Sempra Energy, we actually conducted a study about, you know, practical applications for hydrogen systems and fuel cells. And interestingly, the report came back from a well-recognized business strategy consultant that the emerging hydrogen economy will first gain a foothold in stationary power, followed by transportation solutions, which were viewed to be, you know, very distant in the future because of the need for a more compact solution and increased reliability, et cetera. So the idea is that we'd first be successful in producing power on a grid or skid packages for homes and businesses, also for backup power solutions. And eventually this technology would find its way into the automobile, into trucks.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting, I found that it seems like we've had kind of a mixed bag, right? We first had, maybe you could kind of talk about the history of the various technologies and maybe some of the key successes and failures over the past 30 years on how and where we are today, you know, compared to where we were back in the 1990s.
Yeah, that's a very interesting observation, David. Certainly, there were many stationary fuel cell applications, primarily fueled by natural gas and biogas, a renewable fuel that we must use in perpetuity. There were stationary systems that were deployed well before automobiles were. And that's primarily because of a cost consideration, but also because of a technology evolution in particular to engender very high power density like the automobiles required. So there were two main things that held up transportation applications in the early going. It was high cost in comparison to the internal combustion engine alternative and the power density that could not be competitive with the internal combustion engine at the time. But making relatively larger power plants and with a little more expense for power generation enabled many different companies to make fuel cells for stationary power. And stationary power, together with heat and even cooling, was common. And we have more than a gigawatt of these kinds of systems already installed all around the world, with primary markets in California, the Northeast, Korea, Japan, and the like. So these kinds of systems absolutely did evolve, and they were primarily using natural gas that was pipeline delivered through the natural gas system. Interestingly, the technology both for stationary power and for transportation applications has improved very dramatically over the last several decades. And in particular, with regard to the power density and the lowering of cost, that enabled them to compete directly on a performance basis with internal combustion engines and batteries for vehicles. And what that left behind is the infrastructure for fueling those vehicles, which from my perspective is now the biggest hurdle for introducing hydrogen fuel cell electric vehicles. So there's been quite an evolution in both the technology and in the marketplace that has us currently understanding that both stationary power and transportation applications will become quite commonly used in our zero emissions future and are already available commercially today.
Now, as we look back over the past 30 years, we had a variety of fuel cell technologies, including PEM, solid oxide fuel cells, molten carbon, and phosphoric acid. Could you just briefly describe those technologies and where they are today and whether they're still used in society?
Yes, absolutely. So all of these fuel cell types have different features, and as a result, it's likely that all of these will continue to play a role in our zero emissions future. So for example, the proton exchange membrane fuel cell technology and proton exchange membrane electrolysis technology, which, as you may know, electrolyzers are essentially the opposite of fuel cells. Electrolyzers take in electricity and make hydrogen and oxygen out of water. Fuel cells take in hydrogen and oxygen and make water and electricity. Okay, so I'm going to talk in general about these technologies on both the fuel cell and on the electrolysis side. So proton exchange membrane cells are some of the highest power density cells that are made. And as a result, they work very well in transportation applications. So all of the major automobile manufacturers, those who are making forklift trucks and those who are making long-haul trucks and medium-duty vehicles and things like this, they're all using proton exchange membrane technology. And that technology is advantageous for a number of reasons. It operates at low temperatures and has this high power density. And so it can stop and start quickly. So you can go into your garage and start your fuel cell vehicle and it can immediately provide you power as you would desire for a transportation application. The what those fuel cells require, on the other hand, is pure hydrogen. And pure hydrogen has to be dispensed at these fueling stations that I think are the primary hurdle for widespread adoption and commercial use of PEM technology in transportation applications. Then we go to other fuel cell types like the medium temperature phosphoric acid systems. And these are interesting because they also can be more highly dynamic in their operation. And we have systems that today are operating on the grid and providing islanding and dynamic operation to follow loads using both natural gas and biogas, okay? And phosphoric acid systems also are being operating right now on pure hydrogen in one of the biggest pure hydrogen fuel cell, stationary fuel cell power plants. It's a 30 megawatt system in South Korea. Okay, so phosphoric acid has this leading potential for dynamic operation on the grid. And is also readily amenable to hydrogen operation. And then we go to the higher temperature fuel cell types, and these are the molten carbonate and solid oxide fuel cell types. And molten carbonate has the really interesting advantage of being able to do things like carbon separation and sequestration and trigeneration of hydrogen heat and power, which might be very important to the early introduction of hydrogen fueling together with stationary fuel cell production of heat and power. And solid oxide has been invested in recently. It's the highest temperature type of fuel cell technology and has been shown to actually be very fuel flexible, operating on, again, things like biogas, digester gas, landfill gas, also of course, natural gas, and then emerging hydrogen solutions and even reversible cell technology that can both do electrolysis and fuel cell operation at these high temperatures. Now, these high temperature systems take a while to start up, and so they aren't really directly applicable to transportation applications, but rather would be used primarily for stationary applications. But once they are started, they can complement sun and wind power by operating somewhat more dynamically than they are today to complement sun and wind power dynamics.
Well, that's quite a history, Jack. Obviously, there is a multitude of technologies that are available that have been developed over the past 30 years or so. As we think about it from a consumer point of view, and I'm thinking about, you know, either those who are living in a home, working in a business, operating a business, industry, driving a car, as we think about practical applications from a consumer point of view, over the next 10 years, and I realize we're going to be talking more about this in part two of this series, but could you just give a quick flavor as to which technologies are going to be most popular, visible to the consumer? And you already mentioned the PEM technology for automobiles. Is that where consumers are going to be having the greatest touch point and access to this technology?
Well, it's interesting. If you look around the world, I would suggest, again, that all of these fuel cell and electrolysis types will have a role to play and may have various segments of the market that they are dominant in. But certainly when it comes to transportation applications, proton exchange membrane fuel cells are the main choice. And I don't see other technologies competing directly in that on-vehicle platform. On the vehicles, proton exchange membrane, I think, will be forever the kind of fuel cell technology we will use. However, when it comes to consumer access, actually the greatest consumer access has been engendered in the stationary market in Japan. In Japan, both proton exchange membrane and solid oxide fuel cell systems are used in over 300,000 homes today. So there's over 300,000 consumers in Japan that have a fuel cell operating in their homes today. In this kind of sense, your business consultant may have been correct. That's the biggest consumer touch point today. And so what we see is we see those kinds of systems delivering reliable and consistent zero emissions power and heat in those homes in Japan. But we have a similar number of consumers in Japan, in Europe, and in California in particular that are currently buying and operating fuel cell electric vehicles. And these also are proton exchange membrane. Now, I mentioned in Japan, solid oxide and proton exchange membrane are being used in the homes. And that leads me to this difference between solid oxide and proton exchange membrane when operating on a hydrocarbon fuel. When operating on a hydrocarbon fuel, solid oxide has the advantage of fuel flexibility and higher fuel to electricity conversion efficiency. And this is one of the reasons why solid oxide has a very much larger presence in stationary power around the world today. And so if you look at the largest selling systems in the around the world for stationary power, that's solid oxide, molten carbonate, and phosphoric acid. So these have larger market shares than proton exchange membrane does. Why is that? Because they have higher fuel to electricity conversion efficiency operating off of current infrastructure fuels like natural gas and biogas. Okay, so if you're looking at a commercial sized system and you want to operate today off of the infrastructure that's available today, those three systems will be dominant. Okay. And then if you start to talk about the future, our future fuels can be hydrogen fuels, or they can be hydrogen converted to a hydrogen derivative fuel, which may be methane, which may be methanol, which may be DMM, DME, we don't know, but this is gonna be a 100% renewable hydrocarbon fuel that will be used in certain applications. And then again, because of the fuel flexibility of solid oxide, it might be one of the choices that is made in several of these other applications. I suggest that the carbonate fuel cell technology always will have the unique capability to actually separate carbon. And so if you're thinking about a carbon sequestration, a carbon capture and storage concept, that's when carbonate fuel cells, because it's uniquely available to carbonate fuel cells because they transport carbonate ions from the cathode compartment to the anode compartment, concentrating them in a water stream so that just cooling that anode exhaust stream, okay, results in a pure CO2 stream, which can be reused or which can be stored. So again, you can see, depends upon what your application is, then you will have certain technologies that dominate.
Thank you, Jack. That's a really great description of what consumers and customers can expect in the future. I'd like to jump, if I can, to another question, and that is to recognize that there is a that there is a growing need and investment in renewable energy, which must increase dramatically in order to reach a zero net carbon future. Now, yes. This means, of course, more excess renewable electricity, right? Because you have sometimes the difference between demand and supply. And if your supply peaks during the middle of the day in this hot summer period, and then the sun starts going down and your demand is already starting to is going to be peaking from electric utility grid perspective California between 4 p.m. and 9 p.m. There's a difference, right? And so how do you make up that gap as you have excess electricity during the late afternoon to where demand and then starts tailing off, and then you have demand from a customer point of view peaking, there's a gap now. And how do we fill that gap? What are the limitations of the current technologies today?
Yeah. Well, very interesting. You described the daily or diurnal challenge associated with introducing high amounts of solar and wind power, mostly solar. That's the dominant renewable primary energy that we use here in California and in many places around the world. Let me just say that we are very fortunate to live at a time when the cost of renewable sun and wind power has become so attractive as primary energy, and as a result, enabling us to envision with reasonable prices a 100% renewable energy input. Okay, 100% renewable energy input. All the energy that we need can cost effectively come from the sun and the wind power that we have available all around the world in various amounts. Okay, so this is really a wonderful time. And it's also wonderful that we have had policies in certain locations, like in the state of California, in Europe, in Japan, in China, where these technologies were encouraged even before they became so commercially viable. So what is the challenge? You started talking about the challenge as being one that's associated with dynamics. Okay, so this is very, very important, dynamics. And diurnal dynamics for solar have, as you just noted, a very big challenge of excess generation in the middle of the day and very, very low amounts of electricity being generated in the evening when we have the peak demands. And there's this huge ramp in between, too, that is very hard for utilities to manage. And that diurnal variation in demand on the grid could be addressed with hydrogen energy storage. But typically what we're talking about is about 4 hours of storage that is required to move 4 hours of energy from the middle of the day to the evening, and to do it almost every day. And battery energy storage is probably going to be the most popular solution for that. And that's a good thing. We need to install a lot more batteries on the grid, or else we can't keep installing more and more solar on the grid in order to increasingly achieve zero emissions. But once you need energy storage that is longer than the 4 hours, like you sometimes need when you have a whole season's worth of excess energy, which we usually have already in the California grid, we are curtailing, that is wasting or not using, solar energy that is created in the springtime primarily, and we have a need for more solar energy in the winter, and we can't store that seasonal amount of energy in something like batteries without it being exorbitant in its cost. We also have battery self-discharge, which is a phenomenon that is unavoidable with traditional batteries, but which we can avoid with the hydrogen storage concept. Because hydrogen is stored in the tank separate from the electrochemical conversion devices, the fuel cell and the electrolyzer. In batteries, it's all in one unit. The chemicals are right adjacent to the electrodes. So we have two features that hydrogen offers that are going to be required for the large amount of storage and for the long duration storage that the grid will need if we are to continue to put more and more sun and wind power on our grids. And it's really important to understand these technological features because they are unique to hydrogen. They cannot be engendered by any other known zero emissions vector. And maybe I can talk about those a little bit more later.
Thank you, Jack. So when it sounds to me that you're viewing a future that would include both a growing reliance on renewables, solar, wind, and other, batteries for short-term duration storage.
Yes.
And then hydrogen begins to plug these gaps.
Yes.
For long-term storage.
Mm-hmm.
And from a utility grid perspective, and long-term, let's just say, is it fair to say the long-term storage is could be greater than 4 hours and up to several days? Does that make sense?
Yeah, long-duration storage, it could be anything greater than 4 hours from my perspective, but the U.S. Department of Energy and IEA and many others have talked about, and we have done our own analyses that suggest between 100 and 200 hours might be required depending upon the jurisdiction, depending upon the demands, depending upon the availability of sun and wind power in each of these jurisdictions. So we're talking about very, very long duration storage that is required. But we're also talking about storage for a long period of time. What do I mean by that? It means that you store over one season and you deliver it back in another season, and in between you do nothing, right? And that's another aspect of hydrogen energy storage, because we can seal hydrogen in underground salt caverns. We know that's proven technology. I think it's likely that we can seal hydrogen in underground depleted oil and gas fields, like we store natural gas today, and in other purpose-built facilities like large tanks, okay? We can do that with very, very low leakage rates. But we cannot store that same seasonal amount of energy in batteries and leave it there for 6 months without it being self-discharged, okay? And you know this from your own experience. For example, if you don't drive your car for 6 months and you try to start it, because the battery hasn't been charged and discharged every day or every so often, the battery drains. And it's not because it's a bad battery. It's just because of battery technology. That's what happens. There is self-discharge. And then let me talk a little bit more about why the magnitude is enabled by the magnitude of storage of a whole season's worth or whole 200 hours worth. If you think about it, each day you have a certain demand. In the state of California, let's say it's about 50 gigawatts of electric demand. If you are to meet that with sun power, you need to install about four times that amount, like about 200 gigawatts, okay? So, because we have only about a 25% capacity factor with sun. So that means that we have, in the middle of the day, 150 gigawatts, if we're trying to meet the entire state demand with sun power, 150 gigawatts every day that in the middle of the day we have to absorb with our energy storage. Okay, if we need to store it for 4 hours, well, then we have something like 600 gigawatt hours that we need. Okay, 600 gigawatt hours. That's just for storing it for 4 hours, and that means just delivering it from one middle of the day to the evening. Well, what happens if we need to store it for, we need to store seasons worth? Let's say, you know, it's all of excess generation in March, April, and May. Well, then you have order of magnitude 600 times all of those days. How do you engender that with batteries? You buy that many number of days worth of batteries. For every new 4 hours, 4 gigawatt hours, you have to buy another 4 gigawatt hour battery. But because hydrogen energy storage has separate power and energy scaling, the same fuel cell for making electricity at night and the same electrolyzer for consuming solar energy in the middle of the day are able to both do the daily shifting and are sized perfectly also for the seasonal shifting. The only thing you need to do is to have a bigger storage facility. Okay, you build a bigger tank for the hydrogen, or you start using additional facilities for the hydrogen, like the underground pipeline system or storage facilities that we currently use for seasonal storage today. So you can see separate power and energy scaling. The electrochemical conversion devices can be sized for the day, and the tank or underground cavern can be sized for the season's amount of energy. And this is why there's always a crossover point between hydrogen and battery energy storage, where at longer durations, hydrogen energy storage becomes cheaper. For short durations, we absolutely need batteries, and we should use a lot of them. But once you get past the need for that diurnal shift, you're going to start to need things that have longer duration, and that's when hydrogen becomes cheaper. And remember, these are both zero emissions strategies. Neither one of these contributes greenhouse gas or criteria pollutant emissions. So this is where we must go.
Interesting. So you've really laid out a pathway by which in the short term for short-term storage, Jack, we need to continue relying on batteries, and we'll install greater capacities of short-term storage systems featuring batteries principally as probably the most efficient means for storing this energy in the short term, right? And then as we get into more seasonal, longer-term storage, perhaps some heavy-duty applications, which we'll cover in part two, that's where hydrogen really begins to fill important gaps. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It also, on both the transportation side and on the stationary power and grid support side, really shines when we want to achieve full decarbonization, fully zero emissions, because that means that we have to have all of the primary energy coming in as sun, wind, and zero emissions resources, okay? And we have to engender zero emissions in all sectors of the economy, all the end uses. And there just are some where hydrogen makes much more sense. It has features that enables you to decarbonize things in industry, things in heavy duty, things in the grid that you couldn't decarbonize otherwise.
That's terrific. Jack, it's just been incredible covering this history, this fascinating history. You know, moving, just reviewing what we've covered in this particular podcast, we started out talking about the technology development work, the heavy lifting that was resembled to the early days of the renewable technologies, sun and wind, solar and wind technologies, hydrogen and fuel cell technologies also had to overcome significant obstacles, and work, incredible work has been completed over the past 30 years.
Absolutely.
To get where we're now. And now we're seeing, you know, everything, we have these policy requirements for achieving a net zero carbon emissions future. And now what you've really done a great job is really embracing and summarizing the benefits of solar, wind, and batteries. But now we're saying, gee, in order to be successful and really achieve our longer term goals, which increasingly do not seem to be as longer term as we initially thought. We're seeing all kinds of climate change stuff. Right, so everybody's getting on board and saying, wow, we've really got to hammer this home and do it quickly. And what you're saying is, guys, we can't do this, team. We've got to really embrace other emerging technologies, and hydrogen fuel cell technologies can really play a critical role in helping us solve some of our longer term and short, medium, longer term energy sustainability challenges and goals.
Absolutely. And let me just note that I'm very confident that this will be the case. The technical analysis that we've done for more than two decades shows that the technological features required can be delivered by hydrogen. But secondly, I'm very confident in the economic viability of hydrogen fuel cells and electrolyzers. They have had far less investment than solar, wind, and batteries to date, and yet they have come down the cost curve just like sun and wind and battery technologies have. And they're on the steeper part of this cost curve, and they scale similarly. So that I'm quite confident that in the very near future, we're going to see these kinds of technologies also become cost competitive. And then we can engender these features of hydrogen fuel cells and electrolyzers in all of these sectors of the economy in a cost-effective way that industry, consumers will embrace. I very much look forward to that future where the desired end product and the desired features that consumers want will be engendered by hydrogen, fuel cells, and electrolyzers.
With that, we will close out this session, part one of the emerging hydrogen economy. And again, I'd like to thank our guest, Jack Brower of UC Irvine. I am your host for this unique podcast series on the emerging hydrogen economy, David Barakoff, Director of the Energy Practice at LARD Institute. We look forward to continuing this discussion and talking about the practical markets, applications, and the timing of when we see this hydrogen economy emerging into the marketplace. What are the cost targets? How do we get there? And what do policymakers need to do to help encourage greater adoption of hydrogen, renewable hydrogen, and fuel cell technologies in order to achieve our long-term goals? Thank you again, Jack, very much. And we look forward to reconnecting with you all very shortly with part two of this series.
Thank you very much, David. Talk to you later.